Welcome, everybody. It's great to see you all. We will pick up with our continuation of the Zohar. I dare say we are methodically making our way through the Hakdamah, the introduction to the Zohar. It doesn't really matter, but I think we might actually finish it this year, the Hakdamah. It's just a kind of progress. It is.
And we have another 120 years to.
No, I mean, you know, like, in other words, it is all to say.
I'm kidding. I like the pace at which we're going.
Yeah, no, it's a good pace because it's like you, the teachings stay with you, you know, and you absorb them for me. But I also think that if we kept this up for, say, 8 to 10 years, I think we might actually get through most of the Zohar. You know, like there's a sense in which, you know, picture yourself a decade older and you could be, you know, at least have really studied every path. It's not the worst.
And when they ask what you're doing in your retirement, you can say, you know, I'm going through the entire Zohar.
I'm going through the entire Zohar. Yeah. It just begs the question whether we want to have any more longer in-depth sessions or, you know, whether people have life goals of like kind of being exposed to the entire of Zoharic mystical tradition. But anyway, we are making our way through it. So with that, no more time to speak about it because we will dive in. But let me not share my email and instead not a mystical text in the slightest. And we'll still go to the Zohar. You see the Zohar, right? Not my inbox.
Yep.
Great. So last time we finished the teaching that is called Chade B'moadaya V'lo Yahiv L'miske, one who celebrates the festivals and doesn't give to the poor, with, of course, the surprising example of Abraham, who in this narrative plays Job. and we're up to really the next teaching, which is known in the mystical tradition, you should know, as Ma'amar Oraisa Utslosa, or Oraita Utslota, the teaching of Torah and prayer. And this is a short little teaching, enough to say about that. Patach Rabbi Shimon Va'amar, one thing I will say is this about the prior teaching. I wasn't watching the Oscars until they somehow came into public consciousness. Our Zoharic teaching was quoted by Denzel Washington at the Oscars, which rarely happens, where a passage from the Zohar, and then quoted by Will Smith in an overly dramatic, poorly executed, whatever. You don't need my takes on pop culture. But Denzel Washington quoted our Zohar, and Denzel Washington is, of course, a hero. And Denzel Washington said something like, at your highest moments, it's when the devil comes to accuse you, or something like that. And actually, our passage is precisely Abraham at his highest moment, and it's at that very moment that the Satan, here, this demonic devil figure, comes to accuse him. And so I will say that whatever the, you know, parlance of this idea, somehow it has made it into kind of a popular religious conscience as a notion that just at your highest, that's when you got to be careful. So anyway, the Zohar.
That was the explanation that was given for the outbreak of witchcraft in Salem by Cotton Mather, that the success of the colony had been so great, this was a last minute attack.
By Satan. Yeah, so this idea, you know, certainly has, it would be interesting to kind of collect different historical uses and manifestations of this idea, but it's one that we just saw in the Zohar. And so I guess this is not a comparative religion piece, but it seems to be a religious idea that is cultural and cross-cultural, and then it appears in different generations. I don't know that I have more to say about it, but as soon as I heard that statement from Denzel Washington, I was like, that's our Zohar. All right. Patach Rabbi Shimon Va'amar. My dichtiv. What's written, Ve'asev Chizkiyahu panav el hakir v'yitpalel el Hashem, tachazi. Kama hu chela takifa d'oraisa, v'kama hu ilad kola, d'chol man d'ishtadal b'oraisa, la d'achil me'lai umitatai, la d'achil mimarin b'yishin d'alma, Rabbi Shimon opens saying, what is the meaning of the verse? Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Come and see how potent is the power of Torah, how supreme above all. For whoever engages in Torah has no fear of those above and those below, nor of any grave sickness in the world, since he grasps the tree of life and learns from it every day. Now, first, a little narrative background, right? We always in this year like to delve a little bit into the story. What is happening with King Hezekiah in the 38th chapter of Isaiah, pray tell? Anyone?
He's sick.
He is sick. Yes, he is sick. What else? Let's just see it inside.
Oh, I think, yeah, I'm just looking at it. So the Lord said, he's told he's going to die.
He was on his deathbed. He's not just sick. So Isaiah the prophet comes and says to him, God says, get your will ready. You are going to die. God advertising for estate lawyers since ancient days. So Chizkiyahu turned his face to the wall and prayed to God. Vayomar and prayed. Ana Adonai zechar na it asher hitalachti lefanecha be'emet uvelev shalem v'atov b'enecha asiti v'yek Chizkiyahu b'chi gadol. So he said, please, God, or I beg of you, please remember I have walked before you sincerely and wholeheartedly and have done what is pleasing to you. And Hezekiah wept profusely. After, more, prophet says, Haloch v'amarta Chizkiyahu, ko amar Adonai Elohei David avicha, shamati et tfilatecha, reiti et dimatecha, hineni yosif ayamecha chamesh esrei shana. I have heard your prayers, I've seen your tears. I've added 15 more years to your life. Mikaf melech ashor atzilcha, et ha'irazot, v'ganoti al ha'irazot. I will also rescue this city from the hands of the king of Assyria, and I will protect the city. V'zevach ha'ot mit Adonai asher ya'aseh, Adonai tadavar zeh asher diber. So, two things. There's war and deadly illness for Chizkiyahu. The Assyrians are threatening to destroy the entire kingdom, and he is sick and going to die. He turns to the wall and prays, and God rescues him both from the severe illness and from promises to rescue him from the war. Okay. So that's important background. Oh, were you seeing that? Did I share that or no? Oops. Did you follow it in any event?
Yes, we read it. That's fine.
Okay, great. the rabbinic tradition is very interested in this. Chizkiyahu turned his face to the wall and prayed. I do not believe Daniel Matt cites it in the footnote, but he could have. The Talmud in Brachot cites a rabbinic tradition about this passage that want two things. First of all, one should always turn his face to the wall and pray. Hence, the kind of grounding of, I don't know if it's the basis for it, but grounding of the Jewish tradition of praying with your face to a wall, which is a pretty strong Jewish tradition. Yeah, like not just the Western Wall, but there's a sense of the Eastern Wall in the synagogue, not just being like the front row seat, but like praying with your face in the wall. Or if you're at home, praying against a wall. And there are commentators that explain that in rational ways, like if you're at the wall, you won't be distracted by things in the external range of your vision. But there are other explanations about the wall itself. So this, it's important to know, is a mystical diversion on a rabbinic tradition that you should pray with your face up against the wall, ideally. Or if you're in a synagogue, you should like go all the way to the Eastern Wall. And there's also a tradition in the Talmud and Brachot that you should never give up so long as there's any hope. You shouldn't pray a tefillat shav. You shouldn't pray a useless prayer. Like if something is already a foregone conclusion, don't pray to change it, says the Talmud, because that's ridiculous. But if there is a glimmer of hope, still, never give up, says the Talmud. Those are the two lessons it learns from the story of Chizkiah. Pray against the wall and never give up hope. So the Zohar is coming to diverge or augment that, those traditions. And I think we should be grounded in the basic rabbinic traditions, the Niglef, the revealed tradition first. Okay. So they interpret, you wouldn't get this just from the quote, but you do get it from the story. Come and see how potent is the power of Torah, how supreme above all, forever engages in Torah and has no fear of those above and below, nor of any grave sickness or all, since he grasps the tree of light and learns from it every day. Well, that's because Chizkiah, when he prays, what's the prayer? The prayer is, God, I was righteous and observed the Torah all the days of my life. And so they're using that to see, look, the power of Torah is that if you live according to Torah, engages in Torah here, la sok, right? So not just to study it, but to kind of live it righteously, then it will save you from sickness and frankly from war. And so you should always learn Torah because it protects you. It has a potropaic power. Is that the right word here? So, okay. Go into this more. Daha, a right to talif the varnash lemeza ba'orach kashot. Talif le eta hich yatub kamei mari levatla higzera. Dafilu et gezara le delo yitbatel haigzera miyad itbatel bistalik mine. Lasharya le devarnash bahayama. Begin kach baile the varnash ishtaba ba'orite yamama valela velo yitadi mine hada hudichtiv the hakita bo yomam valela. The Zohar continues. For the Torah teaches a person to follow the true path, advises him how to return to his Lord, nullifying that decree. Levatla gezera. So here we are playing on a theme we once had a few dapim ago, a few pages ago, where there was an idea that a tzaddik could annul a decree of God. I don't know if you remember that. So here, where, you know, part of what the Zohar is fun is it cycles back to themes and add layers to them. So how does, now we're how? With more, how does a tzaddik annul a divine decree? So the answer is through the power of the Torah, right? For Torah teaches, and how does the Torah do that? The Torah teaches a person to follow the true path, which is what Chizkiah did, right? So this is all an understanding of what Chizkiah did, advises him how to return to his Lord, Teshuvah, nullifying that decree. We'll get into this mystically in a minute. Even if it has been, yeah?
I'm sorry. Had Hezekiah strayed or departed from the path? Because based on the text here, you know, he's always followed the path. That's the content of his prayer. So why is he even confronted with a deathly illness? Why did he have to return if he's just been a good guy all throughout?
It's a solid question.
I mean, is there a tradition that he indeed strayed in some important, crucial ways and that this prayer is evidence of his returning to the path and therefore meriting that protection?
In the Zohar, there is an assumption that this will be an answer. That illness in and of itself is kind of a feature of demonic powers and the removal of Kedusha or sanctity. In other words, like if there's spiritual wholeness, then illness doesn't come. So I don't know if it's to say that it's almost evident, right? That like, I mean, you could ask the question, what? So all old people are suddenly pretty evil because suddenly old people die a lot. You could ask the same question, who will live, who will die, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Well, how come like old people die every year? Do old people turn wicked? So some people would say, yes, old people are evil. But other people would say a different thing, right? Which is just like the Maimonideans, or the natural way of humans is that as they get older, they age and become frail and are more prone to illness and die in a higher number.
This is the opposite of what is the predominant view in Job. Right. I mean, Job's friends take this line to a certain
extent. Right. You're saying like the line that it's random. It's totally incomprehensible.
Yeah. What Satan said would not happen would be that a person who is no longer having a comfortable life would not be pious.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be that the Zohar is using this passage to illustrate the point, or like, you know, like he never actually, like, he was told by the prophet that he was going to die. So you're saying, like, what's that in response to? It could be in some kind of theology where he's just told that in order to kind of like sanctify him further, right? I don't know. Like, in other words, that the illness is just, I don't really have a great answer to that question. If anyone else wants to think about it. Now, even if it has been ordained, if the decree not be nullified, so right, it's a decree, not only is it a decree, it's an irrevocable decree. Still, it is annulled immediately and removed from him, looming over him no longer in this world. So one should engage in Torah. So that, by the way, is important because I would argue this goes further than the Talmud, which says that you should pray for things that are still possible, but anything that is impossible, you should not pray for. And the Zohar says, even things that are impossible, you should pray for, because the Zohar are always pushing limits, right? Now, not impossible, like it's already happened a different way. So it's not technically a violation of that Talmudic idea, but it is broader than that, which is that even a decree that cannot be nullified could be nullified, which is, of course, a paradox. Looming over him no longer in this world. So one should engage in Torah day and night, never departing from her, as it is written, meditate on it, the Hagita Bo, Yomam Valayla, day and night. If one departs from the Torah or separates from her, it's like separating oneself from the tree of life. Now, if we haven't done this in a while, but what is the secret teaching here? This is a code. How can you nullify decrees in your life? Here we go to the theurgic part. So praying against the wall with mystical intention becomes, if your life is, you know, congruent with the teaching, meaning clearly it's that Chizkiyahu lived in this way. So the wall, what is the wall? Well, the wall is tangible. It's a thing. The wall is also something that seems to separate one place from another. Right? That's what a wall does. What is a wall? So the wall is often thought of as Shechina here, or Malchut. The wall is Malchut. God is in the wall. But it's the most physical manifestation of divinity. A wall, a solid wall. And because it is physical, it seems to impair, obscure spiritual vision of the world beyond. So here you could understand this as being a teaching that what happens in this world, the physical manifestations of this world, yes, in some traditions can be a source of inspiration and religious inspiration, but can also be a source of distraction that obscure the spiritual realms behind them, leading one to believe that the world is only physical. And
that's an interesting comment in light of how the retaining wall in the base of Mikdash, after its destruction, became a focus of prayer, which was never obviously intended to be. and never was when the base of Mikdash was standing.
Right, and now there's a broad sense that people pray not to the, you know, so so I'll just comment about that, right? Like in yeshivas, when you're praying at the Western Wall, you know, rabbis and heads of academy spill a lot of ink telling people that they should pray not directed towards the Western Wall, but towards the site of the temple in Jerusalem, which, you know, if you were standing at the Western Wall, you'd be like facing diagonally towards the middle of Har HaBayit, of the temple now. But many rabbis prefer that you should pray facing the temple now because the idea is to face the temple, not the wall. But in popular culture, people don't really care about the temple. I mean, yes, religious folks that go up or tourists or whoever care about the temple mount, but then archaeologists and political activists, lots of people care about the temple mount. But most people that visit the Western Wall, all those categories excluded, care about the wall, not like the rest of it. Or to the extent they care about the rest of it, that's a tour. But they're here to pray at the Western Wall, not at the temple mount, right? Like the wall is where they put the note and they kiss the wall and they go up to the wall and they take the photo at the wall. So there is a stirring of that kind of theology here about God's presence in the wall, but the wall does obscure God's presence. So when Chizkiyahu turns to the wall, he is engaging in an action that is reflective of the current state of being. And maybe this is an answer to your question, Andy, like what did he do that merited getting sick? Which is to say, he was briefly distracted or threatened to be distracted from connection to the tree of life through the temptations of physicality. Now, here, what physicality? It may be the very sickness itself that is the thing that tempted to distract him from it. In other words, old age in this case, and the illness that comes with it, the pain of suffering. Here we get into a proto-Hasidic teaching in the Zohar, perhaps. The pain of suffering itself served as a source of distraction from divinity. Said more plainly, everyone knows that when you're really sick or in a lot of pain, it's just really hard to focus on much of anything else. You become cranky and whatever, usually, but like people who are really suffering, it's really hard to just be like, suffering is all encompassing, right? So it is the very suffering itself, which you can then ask, well, what causes suffering? But the suffering itself is the thing that causes him to do it. So what does he do? He turns to the wall. Turning to the wall here is, this is just my read. This is just my read. I always try and know, what is the Zohar really saying? Turning to the wall means he embraced his illness. He removed his illness by embracing his illness. In other words, he found God through his illness. In other words, he said, I could view this illness and say, why is God making me sick or why is God killing me? And have the reaction that so many people do. I'm in pain. Where's God in the world? The Holocaust, where's God? Terrorism, where's God? The world sucks, where's God? There's a lot of bad things that happen. This week is a bad week. Last week was a bad week, depending on who you are. Right? For all kinds of reasons, for all kinds of people. But for the Jews, it's often a bad week, no matter where they are. So it's better now than it's been. It's still bad. So here he turned to that. In other words, he said, God is still here. God is in the wall. And by doing that, it actually broke something open. I would say that this read is a version of the teaching of the Yitzchak, of the Kusker. In Shalem Kalev Nishbar, however they quote it, there's nothing so whole as a broken heart. That famous Hasidic teaching. Right, as if to say, actually, allowing himself to fully embrace the pain of his deadly illness and the impending war and the destruction of his kingdom, like it was all falling apart for Chizkiyahu. He turned to the wall. He said, okay, God is still here in the physical manifestations of these things. And because of that great faith, he was actually able to transcend those illnesses. Think Neo in The Matrix, if you've seen The Matrix. I think this is a good, like, he's able to like fully understand the computer generated system that exists and therefore able to like escape it at some point and escape its rules by the end. So this would be a Zoharic version of that. How does Chizkiyahu escape the matrix? But that's what we'll call this, actually, in a title, because I always have to title these after for a YouTube video, and that will be popular. How do you escape the matrix? So he did it by embracing the reality and fully understanding or seeing the godly presence hidden, but imbued within it. And then once he does that, he does teshuvah, it says. Now, teshuvah, as you may remember, is rooted in bina. He's able to ascend the ladder, right? Once he's able to realize that God is still there, he's able to jump into the system and ascend the ladder, the tree of life. And the root of the tree here, which is at the top, oddly, is, because it's a tree if it's upside down, is bina, or the highest place humans can go, the place of teshuva, of return. And when you return to a place of bina, you're in a pre-emanated place. You're back in the womb. And once you're back in the womb, right, it's before anything is manifest. And so in that place, you can annul all kinds of decrees. If you want to annul a mystical decree, you have to be able to work yourself up towards bina. That's the basic Zoharic teaching, because that's the place prior to the decree in the divine emanation system, prior to specificity, where things actually are born and emerge. And so there you can address the kind of root of whatever is going to occur and do a tikkun, do a correction of it. But the impediment to it would be the illness itself or the wall. So Chizkiyahu turned to the wall. So that's, I think, what the teaching is actually really saying, is something pretty, pretty interesting. And I do think it's actually a guide for, well, yeah. And you could understand this in natural ways, right? Which is that if you're able to transcend the kind of stress and of the pain and suffering itself, that may in fact have healing qualities. Okay. You don't have to accept my read. My read is admittedly my read, and it's like a distinct read on this that I could see a lot of other reads. And I could see
a moment of appreciation, you know, like me, who is a novice amongst novices amongst novice. I'm talking about you just generally. I'm on the bottom of the scale of studies here, you know, and I read that original expression, he turned to the wall and prayed. You assume that it's the prayer that is the operative mechanism here, and the phrase to the wall feels like it's not significant, but I do appreciate that on this read, you know, every word matters, and the fact that he turned to the wall and made this prayer becomes maybe as significant as the prayer itself. So I appreciate the depth and beauty of these ideas.
Yeah, I guess what I'll say is, for me, like, lots of people pray. So why are they interested in Chizkiyahu? They're interested in Chizkiyahu because he turned to the wall to pray. And I know, because I also teach Tuesday Night Talmud, that the Talmud in Brachot has an entire tradition about the wall being central. And so I imagine that the mystics are also kind of saying, well, what do we think of the wall? What's the mystical take on the wall? There's a Talmudic take on the wall. What's our take? Yeah.
I didn't want to like complicate this. I think this could work with the read, but I think when I think about Andrew's comment, like the operative thing might also be Vayef Chizkiyahu Bechi Gadol, and like the idea of like the great cry that he puts at the end of this, the weeping profusely, which is also something you see as like a critical part of teshuvah. So I think that sort of brandishes what you're saying in some ways.
Yeah, I will say there's definitely an element of submission in the plain read of the text. He turns to the wall and cries out in prayer, a great cry. There's like
at the time the Zohar was written, was the Kotel a center of Jewish prayer? Was that its waiting?
Who can tell us the status of Kotel in during late 12th and early 13th century?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, it's Ottoman, and it's kind of also, or it's, you know, I'm not sure the history, but if it's either a Crusader city or an Ottoman city, so I wouldn't think so.
Right,
and yeah, given the Ottomans allowed it to be a place of Jewish prayer as long as they paid their taxes on time.
Andy, what do you say about not?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, when the Ramban goes there, there's not even 10 men in Jerusalem. So it seems unlikely that it would be an active place.
And he's contemporaneous with the writing of the Zohar. Yeah, yeah. And so, whatever, we'll take a position on that. But yeah, so, right. So I'm going to go with the answer is no.
Because it works well with that concept of the Kotel being a place where we go, it's particularly before Israel, where we go to wail, where we go to express our pain.
Right, cried at a wall. So this idea of a wailing wall. Yeah. It would be interesting to trace the evolution of the Kotel as a wailing wall and whether it has any kind of relationship to this mystical tradition or other rabbinic traditions. Tachazi. Eta lebarnash kat ihu salik balela al arse bay lekabla le malchuta de leela beliba shlim uliaktima lemimsar kame pikdona denafshe miad ishtaziv mikol marin bishin mikol ruchin bishin vela shaltin ale but zafra kam me arse bay lebrach lemay lemel lebeise lemiskat kame chalet bidachilu sagya Uvasar Kin, Yitzhak Sosiv, Yasiv, Eta, Meinu Navan Kadishan, Tachsiv, Anibrov Chasacha, Vovesacha, Shachva Hechba, Okachacha, Birasacha. So we now transition. This is the same. So kind of the next part of this teaching. Tachazi. Now, a lot of people have pointed out that the Talmud will say Tashma, come in here, and the Zohar will say Tachazi, come and see, as if it's implying something deeper. I don't know if there's anything real to that, but many people have pointed that out, especially if you imagine here that they are notably distinguishing themselves from a rabbinic tradition in the Talmud about this, then they would say Tachazi, come and see deeper. So, the question for you to think about as we try to interpret this next part, what is the transition here between Chizkiyahu turning to the wall and bedtime? We're now in the world of the bedtime Shema. So my question to you is, what does the Zohar, I thought it was a natural transition to go from this within the same teaching to a discussion about what other things should you recite, but more than recite, what should be the animating attitude of like a religious bedtime? So come and see this advice. When one climbs into bed at night, he should accept upon himself wholeheartedly the kingdom on high, and in advance, meaning before falling asleep, deliver to him the pledge of his soul. At once he is protected from any grave illness or maleficent spirit, which are powerless against him. In the morning, upon arising from bed, one should bless his Lord, enter his house, bow down in great awe before his sanctuary, and then offer his prayer. He should seek advice from those holy patriarchs, as it is written, "As for me, through your abundant love, I will enter your house, I will bow down at your holy sanctuary in awe of you." Bani Barov Chasacha Vovetecha, Estacha Vel Hicho Kodchacha, Biratecha. Okay. So, what's going on here? Why are we talking about bedtime? How do we go from this to bedtime? We'll get into what you do at bedtime, but why are we talking about bedtime?
Because sleep is like a wall between your consciousness and where you can direct it.
Right, exactly. In other words, I think the flow is something like this, and there's a few unwritten questions or problems here. A wall. Okay, well, suffering is one barrier to religious consciousness, but another barrier to cognizant religious consciousness is sleep. Because after all, once you go to sleep, another would be intoxication. Once you go to sleep, you don't know what you don't know. You're asleep. So they're now anxious. Wait, the Hagita bo yomam v'layla, meditated on day and night, always, as soon as you depart from having religious consciousness, you're separated from the tree of life and you might die. Well, what about when we're asleep? And now this feels really fraught. It's extremely dangerous. We're vulnerable when we're asleep. And this becomes the root of the idea that there are these demons at night waiting to pounce. Of course, the demons take on a sexual overtone at night. But more fundamentally than that, it's in part about giving up control. You know, if you're a mystic who's a master of your consciousness, how to accept sleep, I think.
Is there a notion of sleep being a kind of death too? You mentioned Denzel Washington. I was thinking that's the Macbeth thing, right? The death of each day's life.
The death of each day's life, or in the rabbinic tradition, sleep is 1/60th of either death or prophecy or both, in different places, right? So there is this idea that sleep is like a mini death, which comes with some benefits. In the Lurianic tradition, sleep is also an opportunity to advance on reincarnation. And this teaching actually features in that a little bit. It's like, well, if I'm going to die and I have to reincarnate so many times, is there a way to come back as a new me in my next life tomorrow? Is the question that the Arizal asked. I mean, I don't know if he asked that question, but since he taught that there is, I'm going to imagine that he first wondered, wait a second, if sleep is like death, maybe I can come back as a different person. To which the answer was yes. Now, when one climbs into bed at night, you should accept the kingdom on high and in advance deliver the pledge of the soul. This is, of course, playing on an idea that is expressed in Adon Olam, which I think we've established was a Spanish piyut from maybe around this time. Rabbi Confer, maybe you know more, but Biado Afkid Ruchi. Be'etishan va'ira be'imruchi geviati Adonai li velo ira, says the song. So here it actually mirrors this passage in the Zohar, right? So you imagine it's the same idea. Biado, in his hand, afkid, the same, pikadon, I will pledge or deposit my soul. Biado afkidruchi be'etishan, when I go to sleep, va'ira, and I am afraid of death and being attacked. Be'imruchi geviati, and if I should die, God is with me and I have no fear, says the end, the dramatic end of this song that we sing and we have like kids sing at the end of the day. It is a martyrdom song, or I'm not afraid of death, but it's a lot of times thing. We're not afraid of death if we die, but anyway, so here, so because of this, either because of this or it was already there in the bedtime Shema liturgy. And you should know that the Talmud taught that you should say the Shema at bed, Abaye in particular, and you should recite the verse, Biadcha Kidruchi El Emet. Does anyone know the verse I'm talking about? If we can find it. Is it linked in a mat, maybe? Yes, Psalms 31:6. Look at it in the Sfaria. Yeah. So you may or may not, if you open your Siddur, you will see that after you recite the bedtime Shema, it says in many verses to say, but one of them you say is, Biadcha afkid ruchi, in your hand I entrust my spirit. Padita oti, you redeem me, Adonai, God El Emet, of God of truth, Lord, God of truth, or something like that. So I deposit my soul with you, is the idea. Now, a few things in the mystical tradition about how exactly you deposit your soul with God. So one way is to say this, but this is actually maybe coded for a series of permutation or meditation practices that folks would do. So today is the secret value-added portion. This is the portion where usually the internet interrupts us because we're going to reveal something too secret. So this is the revealed version of the mystical text. What the mystics say behind closed doors, the following. (Clears throat) So you may know that Biadcha of Kidru Ruchi. Forms an acronym for Be'er, well. Maybe you know that, maybe you don't. So the understanding here is that by reciting this verse, what you are doing, and this I'm taking directly from the interpretation of the Arizal, as told by Chaim Vital in three places, to this Zohar. So this is a Loriot, this is Rabbi Isaac Loria's interpretation, not just a Lorianic interpretation, it's explicitly his interpretation. A well represents Shechina, the place where divine flow fills into the world. And so what you are doing, and a well is filled with water or liquid or flow from above. So what you are essentially doing when you recite Biyadcha Kidruchi is you are attaching your soul to Shechina. You're finding a way to kind of enter, you're moving beyond the physical world into the most divine elements of Shechina, of Malchut, by placing yourself in the well of Shechina, not Shechina unfilled, waiting for divine flow, but Shechina with divine flow. So before night happens and you get separated from your divine conscience, you're kind of advancing, and that's why the Zohar uses the term advance, into the Godhead, up the ladder a little bit, and placing yourself in the river, as it were, of divine flow. That will then elevate you upwards throughout the night. So you're getting your night started by placing yourself with God. So rather than letting sleep, you know, because sleep coming on is a passive activity. So if you're a mystic, you can actively preempt the passiveness of sleep by placing your soul into this river of divine flow by getting into the well. And you can get into the well by reciting Biyadcha Kidruchi and having in mind that you're actually spelling the word well. Now, there's another thing you can do. Biyadcha. Let me draw. So Yadcha in Yadcha. So what is the gematria of Yadcha, the numerology? We have 10 and 4 and 20. What is it equal?
34.
Now, which divine name has the numerology of 34? Not one you've ever heard of. So I'm going to guess. So the divine name, probably unrevealed on Facebook until today, the divine name Bohu. You may say, that's the name of our God? I know of many of them, but what's this one? Now, it does have the right numerology. 6 plus 20 plus 6.
Actually, I thought you were going to say Dal that we had before in this previous passage. Abraham feeding the poor, and you said poor. Dal is the name of the Shechina. Blah blah.
Yeah.
Blah.
Okay. So let's just hold that. Dal is the name of the Shechina, and it's 34. Wow. Okay. Okay. Let's just hold that off. So the Lorianic tradition is when you say Biyadcha, you should meditate on this name. When you say Biyadcha Kidruchi. Whatever the rest of it is, Padito T El Amet. You should meditate on the name Bohu, and that by doing that, you enter the Be'er, the well, or the Shechina, which is Dal. So interesting, the Shechina is Dal is poor when it does not receive the divine flow. But when it does receive the divine flow, and maybe this is what we mean, it's a Be'er, it's a well that's full. Bohu. So this may come from tears of Bichia, maybe kind of evolved from that understanding. The way they derive this name is by taking the name yeah, which is a futuristic name of Keter, of divine flow fully entering the world in a messianic redemption. It's the name of the highest spherot, and by raising it one. So Aleph becomes Bet, He becomes Vav, Yod becomes Chaf, the next letter, and He becomes Vav. And what does it mean to kind of raise the name of Ehyeh one? So Ehyeh is a future redemption, yet unrealized, right? I will be that I will be by the burning bush. Ehyeh, Asher Ehyeh, as Rashi says, I'm with you in this redemption, I'll be with you in future redemptions. So the future redemption hasn't happened yet is the thing. So what's better than the promise of future redemption and hope of a redeemed world? A redeemed world. So in order to do that, if you kind of plus one, as it were, or improve that, or make it real, which is a way the mystics work with names sometimes to do that, then you have this name Bochu, which represents future messianic flow of Ehyeh realized at least a little bit in the present through a mutated form, which may change Dal. Actually, it may be related. It's hard to imagine they didn't, because Dal is one of the common names of Shina. So in any event.
Can I just add one other thing on that code in the name of Rabbi Lehman? I don't know if you were in town when Rabbi Lehman was still active. He loved codes. And I never noticed on the back of the mezuzah is Kuzu B'muchsaz Kuzu, that most people don't know, but using that same code, it's, I think, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. Mm-hmm. Kuf, you know, standing for Yud, you know, the letter before it. But it's interesting, that must be a mystical code use that ended up on the back of mezuzahs, as well as the Ehyeh and the Bochu. It's the same. The same kind of code. You must be aware of the back of the mezuzah. I never noticed it until Rabbi Lehman pointed it out.
Okay, I'm going to do a little digging about that if anyone else wants to. What's the evolution of the code on the back of the mezuzah? But the plus one code.
It's the plus one code. Kuzu B'muchsaz Kuzu.
So, and of course, this is a standard way to create a cipher also, right? It's just, it's a standard code in cipher, right? It's the simplest one, plus one. There was also a way of hiding what you're trying to do. Okay, fascinating. Thank you, Rabbi Comfort. Let us open with that. So we're just going to conclude today then by saying the following thing. If you accept these mystical teachings, which are kind of the accepted Lorianic way to understand this passage, is actually a secret meditative code to do this whole thing when you're going to bed, which you wouldn't necessarily have ever known from the text. It actually is quite the same practice as Chizkiyahu turning to the wall, right? Which is to say embracing the Shechina at a moment when consciousness will be interrupted by the circumstances of humanity, of being human. Right? Being human involves getting sick and dying. Being human involves being subject to war. Being human involves being subject to famine. And being human involves going to sleep at night and not knowing if you'll wake up in the morning. These are maybe the core anxieties of being human and what they have in common, right? Death, war, plague, and famine. Maybe those are the biggest ones. So, what the teaching is giving is instruction in both of those cases about what a mystic can do to transcend the end of life, or the fear of the end of life, or the suffering that causes that, and be attached still, even in the hardest moments or moments where consciousness is gone or where suffering is present, to God in a way that you can kind of live beyond or through that. But it's not by running away from these things. It's not by like being afraid to go to sleep, so like staying up all night. And it's not by like running away, but it's turning to the wall, or here, biyad chav kidruchi, trust in God. and actually advancing sleep even further by depositing, taking your soul and leaving it with God and leaving your body behind in an out-of-body experience, even before sleep does it to you. Right? So both of these involve a kind of doubling down on the thing that's going on, embracing your suffering, or like not running away from sleep. Next time, now that we're here with a teaching that's really about embracing your suffering, the Zohar will give us a teaching about Rabbi Shimon's suffering and afflictions in his cave that he spent 13 years in. And a lot of commentators spill a lot of ink. What does Rabbi Shimon in the cave have anything to do with this teaching? What does it have to do with it at all? We have some stuff to do first. We have to do Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov at the end of the teaching. But after that, people wonder, like, what does Rabbi Shimon's suffering in the cave have to do with this teaching? You have to get into the teaching a little bit. You have to understand what, because the Zohar is a practice guide that's coded. It's not just a text. So we could study it, but I'm more interested in it as like an actual guide to mystical practice, where it's relevant how mystics throughout the ages have understood and taken it. So today, today's class was brought to you both by Denzel Washington at the beginning, and then also by the Arizal at the end, who had something to say also about how the Zohar should be interpreted and what this all means. So I thank you all for your participation and additional mystical insights. Let's also flag up the next time the mezuzah and its cipher.
All right. Catch you next week. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom.
Yes.